We sat down with Johnny Carrabba, the founder of Carrabba's Italian Grill, to talk about the unique dining experience at his restaurants.
We wanted to have an open kitchen because at my grandmother's house, we'd all gather in the kitchen and watch her cook. If you go to a Carrabba's, you have people cooking, sauteing, but they're part of the dining experience, and that was not by accident.
Experience Carrabba's new fall specials tonight, like rigatoni martino and prosciutto and fontina stuffed pork chop. Plus, during our wine harvest, get $10 off bottles of wine throughout October. Only at Carrabba's.
Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. My internet is a little wonky today, but I have a very special program for you. Let me just dial in one more guest before I tell you all about it. Don't go away. I think you're going to love this show.
Hello.
Hi, Wallace. This is Pam from Authors on the Air.
Hi.
Folks, you are now live with Wallace Strobe, who is my guest host, and the wonderful, the incredible, the legendary Lawrence Block. Hi, Larry. How are you?
I'm good, Pam. Good to talk to you.
Thanks so much for being here today. I'm so thrilled that you both are on the show. This is a very special in conversation. I want to tell you, first of all, that I am only the technician today, but Wallace Strobe, whose current book is Some Die Nameless, you know him because he's been on this show. He's an award-winning journalist and the author of The Devil's Share, Shoot the Women First, Kings of Midnight, Cold Shot to the Heart, Gone Till November, The Heartbreak Lounge, and The Barbed Wire Kiss, which has been nominated and won many awards. I'm turning this show over to Wallace Strobe so he can tell you about LB. Go ahead, man. It's your turn.
We don't have enough time to go into LB's illustrious career. But I can kick this right off because that kind of folds into my first question for you, Larry. You just turned 80. You've got 60 some years in the business, conservatively about $125, right?
Probably more than that, but I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Okay. Six-time Edgar winner, including a Grandmaster Award. And coming up, I count two new anthologies you're editing, a new Matt Scudder novella next year, a graphic novel adaptation of one of the earlier Scudder novels that came out earlier this year, and two new films. So how's your retirement going?
I've made an absolute hash of retirement. It just doesn't seem to work for me.
So you've tried and couldn't do it?
Well, I never tried it. It has seemed to me from time to time as though I'm probably done with at least with the heavy lifting, and that is very likely true. I haven't done a full-length novel in several years now, and I suspect I may be through with that.
Now, you've been writing so long, since you were in your late teens, I would think, you know, most of your life. You define yourself by your work for so long and for so many years. Can you even imagine, though, a life in which writing isn't a part of it in some fashion?
No, but even if I'm not writing it, it'll be a part of it. There's so many things that keep me at my desk a certain number of hours every day. I'm doing a lot of self-publishing. I've developed something that's very interesting. I was annoyed that some of my books just weren't getting the foreign sales that they used to, and I've teamed up with translators in Germany and Spain and Italy on a shared revenue basis to translate the books and self-publish them. So that's been interesting. I don't know that that is particularly profitable, but it fills hours in an interesting fashion.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the new Scudder novella, A Time to Scatter Stones, right? And it's
sure.
It's out in January or February?
End of January. Subterranean
okay.
Press will be doing a hardcover trade and limited edition, and I'll be doing it in e-book, and several months later, probably, sometime in the spring, I'll bring out a paperback as well. It's a Matthew Scudder novella. It runs about, I think, close to 30,000 words, but I don't remember the exact number. And it's set in present time. And, you know, I decided fairly early on, or the decision made itself, but that Matthew Scudder would age in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, you know, the poor son of a bitch is as old as I am at this point. And I think aging in real time is a mistake for all of us, but certainly in some respects for fictional characters, because, you know, here's this detective action hero who was really a little long in the tooth for leaving tall buildings in a single bound. And I figured it was probably time for him to have a rest, and then this came together, and I had a great deal of enjoyment writing it. As I said, it's set in the present. It's set in when Scudder is recruited to come to the aid of a young friend of his wife, Elaine's, who is trying to quit prostitution. Not Elaine, she quit quite a few years ago, but this is a young woman who's quitting the game and who has a client who won't let her get out,
mm-hmm.
and is menacing her. And I realized that this was a case that only someone like Scudder could do anything about. The police certainly would just shine her on, you know. And in the book, Scudder points out years ago he could go to the cops with this when he had friends on the force, but now that would get him nowhere, and it would get her nowhere. And an order of protection would be useless, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I had him in something where his participation made sense to me. And then I just wrote the thing and liked the way it came out. I think it's just about the right length for the story. I don't think it would have served to stretch it out to full novel length.
So would you call that a novella at that length?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
That seems to be the going term.
Now, here's that kind of leads to my next question. Scudder's journey has been, I mean, far from direct. I mean, you stopped writing about him several times. The first book was 76, right? Sins of the Fathers?
That's right.
And there's been, 17 novels and a short story collection about him.
That's right.
But there were often big gaps. Now, you probably don't even remember this, but I interviewed you once back in 1987, not that long after When the Sacred Gin Mill Closes, for a newspaper piece. And you at that point said that you at that point said that you were done writing with him, writing about him, that you were pretty certain you'd said all you had to say.
Well, it seemed that way. It also seemed that way before I wrote When the Sacred Gin Mill Closes, because after 8 Million Ways to Die, it felt as though while that was the fifth book, and while each of the five was a novel in and of itself, in a sense, the five books constitute a big novel with a revelation and a catharsis,
mm-hmm.
and a resolution, and I thought I'd unfortunately brought things to the point where my character's Detra had no raison, as you might say. And, you know, that he'd solve the central problem or come to terms with the central problem in his existence, and why write more about him? And when The Sacred Dreamwell Closes was a flashback novel that, that worked well and is the favorite book in the series for a lot of people, but it looked like a dead end. I couldn't have him doing flashbacks forever. That we all know drunks like that who keep telling you the same story over and over, and I didn't want that. And it took several years of letting it lie fallow and not even thinking about it when I realized that, yes, I could write more about Scudder. So I think I've been very fortunate in a couple of things as far as the Matthew Scudder series is concerned. One is that I haven't pushed it. When there hasn't been a book to write, I haven't tried to write one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good, because otherwise this would have burned out and gone away a long time ago.
Yeah. What's interesting is that when you did go back to writing about him, Cutting Edge, was that the first one when you went back? The run of books that followed that, Walk Among the Tombstones, Dance at the Slaughterhouse, Devil Knows You're Dead, are not only some of the best in the series, but some of your strongest work. So, I mean, when you came back to him, you were suited up.
Yes.
Did you feel that sense of energy? Because those books are pretty much back to back. I mean, you were writing other stuff in between, but
no, they were just about a book a year for a stretch there. That's very true. They just something really energized me, I guess, because I agree that they're the stronger, certainly among the stronger books in the series, and they came one right after another for a stretch there.
Mm-hmm. You want to talk a little bit about this great graphic novel adaptation of 8 Million Ways to Die, which John Snyder did, which really came out well. I've seen the book. I have the book.
I'm absolutely crazy about it. The deal began to come together, I think, about 6 or 7 years ago anyway, when IDW wanted to option the right to do, I think at the time they were thinking in terms of 2 Matthew Scudder books as graphic novels. And I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it, to tell you the truth. I didn't think much about it. My agent said he thought it couldn't hurt, and I figured, like almost all subsidiary rights deals that one gets involved with, it would go away, that nothing would come of it. And I didn't think that much of the medium of graphic novels, I must confess. I was never a fan. The ones that I read seemed like an almost juvenile format to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have objection, really, to having my work published in that medium. All it could do was add readers. It wasn't going to alienate any. But I didn't give much thought. And when suddenly early this year the word came that the book was complete and it was going to be published and everything, I hadn't had a conscious thought of it in years. I thought that was completely dead in the water. And then they sent me a PDF of the thing, and it was terrific. I never expected to be crazy about it the way I was. John Snyder is a spectacular artist. He's also, really, you have to call him a writer. He wrote all the text for the adaptation, and his fidelity to the book astounded me. You know, he's getting the entire novel into far fewer pages and far fewer words than I use, and not much is left out. And everything feels right. And it even looks like New York in 1982. You know, to my mind, he did everything right. So I wound up being an enormous fan of the book, and by extension, a fan of the medium, to the extent that this is a representative of the medium. And I just hope that he'll get to do some more. We will see how that happens.
Yes, it's very evocative, especially of the New York of that period, which at the time that you wrote the novel was contemporary and is now almost a period piece, looking back on it.
Absolutely true, yes.
But it really sort of nails that. I was very impressed with the book when I saw it, too. I had a similar reactions in the past to that format. I never really thought something clicked, but this book I definitely felt was a step in almost a different direction. And
yep,
yeah, it boils down a lot of the, you know, what's a fairly complex, and at that time I think it was the longest Scudder book by far.
By far, yes. It was double the length of the ones that went before it.
But he managed to capture all the major beats of it and the tone and the emotional tone as well as the plot.
Yep.
Which a lot of it he did with the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So are there plans to do more in that medium? Are you interested now in doing more in that medium?
Well, I'm very interested. John is very interested. He would really like to do more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what book we would do next, and I don't know whether a deal will come together or not.
Yeah.
We're waiting to see.
You know, it struck me, speaking of 8 Million Ways to Die, which is, you know, a very strong example of this, is that a lot of the Scudder books, actually I would say all the Scudder books, they're very much about mortality and the randomness of fate. I mean, it's even in the titles. And as I said to you once, reading those books in my 20s, very different from rereading them recently, which I've done in my 50s. They're almost different books now. What once seemed maybe an overly hard-boiled, affected attitude about life and death now seems like a more accurate reflection of the way the world really is.
Mm-hmm.
So how old were you when you first started writing those?
Well, I started the first Scudder book in 73 or 4, I think it was. So I was, whatever it was, 35? Yeah.
So he's been, he's sort of been the companion for yourself. I mean, you've checked in with him at various periods of his life and your life.
Right, right. We're about the same age, though. I didn't even think much about that when I started writing the books. I
mm-hmm.
if anything, probably thought he was a couple of years older than I.
Mm-hmm.
But and I never had to be specific. There was never a reason to be. Until a book called The Long Line of Dead Men, which is so completely about, or so largely about, aging and mortality and the passage of time,
mm-hmm.
that to be nonspecific about Scudder's age in all of that struck me as evasive.
Okay.
And I've had to figure out how old he was. And I really had to figure out because I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about it, and I thought back, and I thought the present, and I thought, you know, if he's the same age as I am, then I'll never have to figure it out again. So that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
For someone who's had such a dedicated fan base for so many years, I mean, there are people that have literally been reading you since you were first published. Is there ever a conflict, you feel, between what you need to do creatively for yourself and giving your readers, you know, you're imagining them out there and you've been in contact with them, giving your readers what they want or think they want, either from the author or from the characters or from which characters you write about?
I really don't think I pay attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to know what one does unconsciously. But I really just try to write what I want to write. And I think doing that serves all of us best, but I'm spoiled. I can only write what I want to write.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned to me once you had pushback from the editor on the Scudder novel, The Devil Knows You're Dead, because Matt has an affair, despite the fact
right.
that he committed a relationship
right.
with Elaine. I mean, is there...
Right. The editor had a nice woman in that, and she just couldn't understand it. Here, Scudder has this really good thing going with Elaine, and he sleeps with a client and continues to do so. And she said, why on earth would he do that? What's the matter? Why, you know, how can you have him do it? And I said, men are like that. Get used to it. And I don't think she really too much wanted to hear that. But I've always been inclined to follow whatever my instincts are about what the character should do, how the character feels, anything like that. I can't imagine that the books would work as well if I didn't.
Yeah. It seems to me with that book that Matt having an affair is actually plays in very much with the theme of the book, which is, you know, we're all looking for something. We're all looking for an escape hatch. We're all looking for some place we can go where things aren't as cold. And I mean, I think that really, you know, there's a parallel story in there with a friend of his who's ill who wants a gun to possibly kill herself or not, or just
right.
have it
yeah.
around. And that seems to tie in with what's going on with Matt in that book as well.
That's a thought. I never thought of it in those terms, but I think that makes sense.
Yeah. Now these let's talk about these two new anthologies you have. Now are they coming out at the same time, simultaneously, or?
No, I think the one you're in, At Home in the Dark, Subterranean will be publishing that, and I believe fairly early in the year, in 2019, I think late winter or early spring would be my guess.
Mm-hmm.
I know the cover art is just about ready, and I've turned in all of the content, so I think we're in good shape. And Bill likes to move rather quickly. Bill Schaefer at Subterranean Press is going to be doing this. And the other, From Sea to Stormy Sea, which is the third art-linked anthology preceded by In Sunlight or in Shadow, which is stories based on Edward Hopper's paintings, and then Alive in Shape and Color, which is various artists whose work is reproduced, and their paintings that inspired the 17 stories in that book. And this new one, From Sea to Stormy Sea, is limited. It's just American artists. And instead of giving people free rein, I picked a selection of representative paintings and let people choose among them. I picked about 30 paintings and there'll be 17 stories.
Mm-hmm.
And
see some of the contributors.
Sorry.
Some of the contributors to that book.
Let me think. I always go blank on a question like that. And, of course, I don't have anything written down that's at hand. But Jane Hamilton has a story in it.
Mm-hmm.
My God, who else? Barry Maltzberg.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Phillips. and I have no idea why I've gone so blank on the whole contest page. And they're wonderful stories. I'll just tell you that.
How have you found the editing process being an editor on the anthology? I mean, you've done a bunch.
Yes.
I don't edit a lot. Mm-hmm.
I don't edit a lot. And I've found it pretty okay every once in a while. And this latest anthology, there were two stories that just didn't work at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't get anywhere, and I paid those contributors a kill fee and said we had to let it go. But that hadn't happened before. A couple of times I've come up with suggestions for writers for changes, but nothing major.
Mm-hmm.
I really have no desire to be either Maxwell Perkins or Gordon Lish, you know.
You've written eight books, I think eight books for Writers, and for many years you did a
something
regular
like
column
that, yeah.
for Writer's Digest magazine. So the question remains, can writing be taught? Is it something that's teachable?
Well, it's something that's learnable. And I think all the teaching of writing can do is somehow foster an environment in which somebody can learn.
Mm-hmm.
You ultimately teach yourself. There are things, you know, there's differences between a visual artist. An instructor can teach you how to mix colors, how to do underpainting, how to do various things that you wouldn't know how to do without being taught. With writing, the process is self-evident. How did you do this? Well, I took these words and I put them in this particular order.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at a book and there's no underpainting there that you have to be able to grasp. It's what you see. That doesn't mean that it's easy to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me there's no that the advice would really come in handy for somebody who's already involved in the process.
Mm-hmm.
There's no advice you can give that's going to get somebody into a chair for one or two or three or four hours a day, or to get the level of concentration needed.
Right, right. And not everybody really wants to concentrate that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people would like to be writers, just as any number of us would really like to be rock stars. It's not that easy to make it happen. And it's not something that absolutely everybody is capable of.
Yeah. As a writer, I think what I've learned from your work, especially the Scudder novels, which I read, you know, the majority of those in my 20s when I was in my formative years and just absorbing everything that I was reading, I think one of the things I've learned, which I've carried into my own work, I hope, is to set it up immediately in the first pages if you can. Set up the problem, the mystery, the right way, and fill in the tone and the setting and the atmosphere as you go along. I notice on a lot of those Scudder books that plot is set in motion really within the first few pages. He gets a call for help, or in the other novels, you know, the non-Scudder novels, a drifter gets into trouble, usually women trouble, in a small town. It's an almost classical approach, isn't it? It's like the key is introduce, develop, resolve. And I think when people ask me about, aspiring writers ask me who they should read, I tell them to read Elmore Leonard and Richard Price for dialogue, and I tell them to read you for craft and structure.
Huh. Interesting.
It's probably very organic for you. You probably don't even think about it, I would imagine.
No, I can't. I don't. No, a model I use is to explain how I write books, and also it also works for how my characters solve crimes. Is the moron who found the lost horse when nobody else could, and they asked him how he managed that, and he said, "Well, I just asked myself." If I was the horse, where would I go? And that's how I write. That's how my characters live their lives. I trust that there's an underlying structure in the novels, but I don't think in those terms when I write it. I remember Don Westlake and I were talking one time about the term subplot, and I said, what is that exactly? And he said, I don't know. He said, I've wondered myself. He said, I think it's what the characters are doing when they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, and that was okay. I sort of got that. No, but I sometimes feel a bit of an idiot savant when it comes to writing. I really, it seems strange because I write books on the craft, but there's an awful lot that I do that I don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. I think the influence on me in that respect has been. I feel if I'm not setting the story up in the first few pages, I'm not doing it right.
Mm.
Because even though, in your work, as evocative as it is, especially the New York books, and you've set, many, many, many books in New York, that plot is set in motion fairly early, and then the atmosphere tends to be blended in kind of naturally with it, as opposed to, like, long descriptions of the city or weather or something like that.
Yeah, I generally get things started right away. You know, the world has really changed over time. I remember when I was reading, I think it was A Study in Scarlet. I think it was the first Holmes
mm-hmm.
novel. And I read the first through that, in which essentially nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long stretch. And it sort of sets the scene in his apartment in Baker Street, whatever. And I think Watson comes in or something like that. But the story doesn't start at all. Not at all. And it was all a good maybe 8 or 10,000 words, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really startling, granted, this was a more leisurely period when it was written than the one we live in now. But that was serialized in Strand Magazine. So the entire first installment, which was all people got to read for a month or a week or whatever it was, but nothing, essentially nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't do that now. It wouldn't occur to anybody to move at that kind of pace now.
I think also probably just the way narrative has changed, the way people view narrative now, I think is probably a lot different from then.
Sure.
I mean, have you found yourself having to make alterations in your work? Have you gone back and thought it's not moving fast enough, or it's not vivid enough, or it's not something or other that would take it out of that organic feeling and more into a craft thing?
No, I don't think so. I can't recall ever doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the world of publishing has changed, and it's all changed some since I've been doing it. But I don't know how differently I write now from when I began.
You've wholeheartedly embraced. does that feel like? I mean, you enjoy that, I imagine, or you wouldn't be doing it. How do you find that's worked out for you? Do you think it? I mean, is it something that's essential, or is it something that's secondary? I guess.
Well, it's certainly secondary. I don't know to what extent. I've been spending less and less time on Facebook over the past couple of years, really. And I use it really just to post when I have something to say. One thing I did with Facebook was that I accepted all friend requests until I got up to whatever the maximum was. I think it's around 5,000. And the result of that was that I didn't even look at the news feed. You know, I never do because it's all, you know, tons of stuff by people I barely know. So
yeah.
I only notice what comes directly my way.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably spend more time on Twitter. It's very interesting the way the way social media draws us all together, or has the illusion of drawing us all together.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think I would serve myself better by getting off both of those things and staying off, you know. It's something to do when one's playing with one's phone.
Gentlemen, I want to step in here, and I'm sorry to do that because we have like 5 minutes left, and I want to ask you both some questions. LB, I've been a fan of yours forever, and I love all your work. I wonder if you could tell me, how do you perceive the industry from when you first began to where you are today? What has changed substantially in your mind?
I'm not sure what you mean, Pam.
Well, in other words, when you first were published, you know, were you heavily promoted? Was it easy for you to get into bookstores? Did you have to have an agent? You know, I hear questions from younger writers all the time who think that the good old days have passed them by. I wonder if that's true. Is publishing the same then as it is now, other than the fact that the houses have all consolidated?
Well, the fact that the houses have all been consolidated is an extraordinary change in and of itself. You know, I think it's very difficult for new writers now, and I think it has always been very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I think it always is in the arts, and I think a high bar is probably inevitable and probably a good thing.
Interesting. Wallace, I want to ask you a question. You've not been writing as long as LB has. I think he's the master of the written word, obviously, and why so many people always say they read his books for writers, which is a very common theme with authors I interview. Are you going to write as long as Larry's writing?
I would hope. From your lips to God's ears, as they say. Larry's one of my idols in that sense because he has kept going very strongly for a long, long period of time, which is a rare thing. There's not
it
many
is,
other
indeed.
Writers who have done that. James Lee Burke has also. I think
yes.
he's actually
yeah.
a little older than you, Larry, by 1 or 2 years.
Just a year or two. I haven't seen Jim in a long time.
He'll be back here in January. He comes every January to the show. I'm really excited about that. I want to just kind of close off with saying, first of all, LB, I understand about Facebook. I think if I didn't have this network to manage, that I wouldn't be on it either. It is an exercise in frustration for sure. But thank you for coming on the show despite that. And it was such a pleasure to meet you both at Thriller Fest and BoucherCon this year. And I'm delighted that you've emailed me. I'm like framing those emails. I'm hanging on to them saying, I know Lawrence. I know Larry Block, you know, and that's a pretty cool thing. Wallace, this is now your third visit to my show. Once when we interviewed one-to-one, and then at BoucherCon, you generously stepped in and gave us some really great advice. And now as host to LB here, what's next for you?
In terms of hosting, I don't know.
Well, you can come and host anytime you want. What's going on? I'm glad to open up the studio to you. Are you ready to release another book anytime soon?
No, I'm working on a new book, which is another standalone.
Okay.
And I promised my editor at Mulholland some pages next month, so I'm starting to get a little paranoid about that. And you know,
let me jump in for 1 second, Pam,
to
say that Wallace did a Chris Stone story for At Home in the Dark, and it is just wonderful. I've been crazy about the character since the first one that I read, and I'm so glad to have that story in the book.
Thank you.
Well, I can't wait to read the book, too, when it's out. I want to tell you both how much I appreciate you taking time from your busy schedules to be here. You are my birthday present to me today. I want you to know that. I stayed home because I so wanted to talk to you both, and I want to thank you. You've absolutely made my 29th birthday a joy, or the anniversary of my 29th birthday a joy. And I hope that you'll both come back, and if I don't talk to you earlier, I wish you the happiest holidays and with my gratitude. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank
happy
you,
birthday.
And thank you. And folks, that's the end of our show for now. I'll be back in a little while with Lou Burney, another exciting author that I can't wait to talk to. Lawrence Block and Wallace Strobe, you know where to look for them. Just Google their names and all of their information comes up. Thank you so much, gentlemen, and we'll talk again soon. Have
thank
a great
you.
Day.
Sure.
All righty. All right. Thank you. And thank you, Mom and Dad.
Florida stone crabs are finally back in season, and we got them at Bonefish Grill. They're delivered fresh from Florida docks right to our restaurants, and then served the way they're meant to be served, cracked and chilled, ready for dipping in our house-made mustard sauce. These native stone crabs pair perfectly with our handcrafted seasonal cocktails. It's the most delicious time of the year here in Florida, so come into your local Bonefish Grill to claw your way out of ordinary tonight.
We sat down with Johnny Carrabba, the founder of Carrabba's Italian Grill, to talk about the unique dining experience at his restaurants.
We wanted to have an open kitchen because at my grandmother's house, we'd all gather in the kitchen and watch her cook. If you go to a Carrabba's, you have people cooking, sautéing, but they're part of the dining experience, and that was not by accident.
Experience Carrabba's new fall specials tonight, like rigatoni martino and prosciutto and fontina stuffed pork chop. Plus, during our wine harvest, get $10 off bottles of wine throughout October, only at Carrabba's.